Welcome to AVT. And doesn't that intro just get you excited?
That was awesome, dude.
Gets AVT, me super pumped.
Where two men enter and only one man survives. For those that don't know, AVT stands for Atheist Versus Theist. It's where you can give us a call, ask any questions you like on religion, politics, and current affairs, and get two unique perspectives. My guests for the evening are Secular Rarity and Eddie from Brute Facts. How you guys doing?
Fantastic.
Yeah, I'm excited, man. Eddie and I have had
it out in the ring.
Yeah, Eddie and I have had some good conversations in the past, but we are here today for the fieriest dumpster fire. This is going to be bloody. This is going to be brutal. So this is a warning for everybody out there right now. If you're not ready for that level of intensity, I don't know what to tell you.
Well, it all depends on how much Secular's had to drink. our funnest exchanges were when we both had a little bit to drink and kind of loosened up.
We do so. That. I don't know what it is about the. There's probably some medical something that will tell us why, but I think it'll be a lot of fun. So,
not that I'm encouraging the use of alcohol, but hell, start drinking.
Hey, I've already started. I got these little.
If it'll make the seltzers. Show more interesting.
I had to give my liver a rest with the bourbon, so I went to something a lot lighter.
That's good. That's good. Yeah.
I'm more of like a vodka or tequila person.
Oh, no.
Well, okay. What about gin? What do y'all think about? Okay. See, I've never gotten into it either, but a buddy of mine swears by it. He says, seriously, it's the best thing in town, man.
Bad experience really with gin?
I don't think so.
I don't know. It tastes like pine needles to me.
We had back in the day, it was gin and juice. Mm-hmm, so we had some Tanqueray, and I grew up with a groupie kind of mom. So I learned how to play quarters at a young age, and they wanted to play quarters with me with gin. Well, needless to say, I had several people throwing up in the house, and all I could smell was gin and throw up. And that was the last time I drink gin.
I'm with you, man. I'm not going to drink gin. But my worst, before we jump into the questions, I'll summarize this real quick. Jaeger is like my alcohol kryptonite. Even the thought of it turns my stomach.
Man.
Not a fan of Jaeger either.
I don't know the history behind it, but it was a bad choice. It was a bad choice, I think. But,
What are you drinking?
Anyways, okay. So before I get started with my first question, I do want to encourage people to call in because this show runs much better when we get calls from our viewers with questions for our two hosts, preferably ones that make them go back and forth and battle it out and make the show more fun and interesting. But my first question is for you, Eddie, and then Secular, you'll have a chance to respond. What is your most compelling, like, what reason do you find most compelling to believe a God exists?
Intuition. Just without bloviating on it, went through a deconstruction, never could get away from the idea that something existed, and went on a journey to find out what that something was, and came to believe that a God existed. And through comparative religion and going through all the world's major religions, Christianity seemed to make the most sense to me as far as God existing. But initially it was, we don't get to choose everything we believe necessarily. And, just always had this idea that there was something bigger, greater, something that existed outside of, experience as we experience it.
Is that it? Am I the same question? What do I think is the best reason to believe, or the best reason not to believe?
Oh, no, you would now respond to what he
said. Oh, okay. Yeah, cool. Because I do think, while I feel like at the end of the day, that still kind of boils down to I had a personal, non-repeatable experience, I still do think that is probably what I consider to be one of the best arguments. I don't think trying to go through, you know, like the Kalam or the contingency argument is really what drives most people to believe. I think it's helpful to have that. But I also don't think the vast majority of us that are non-believers, I don't think, you know, we woke up one day and we're put our boots on and we're like, I'm going to be 100% logical and follow the data and the science. And I think we like to talk like that, right? But when I did believe, when somebody asked me, why do you believe? I think I probably would have answered almost exactly the same way. The intuition, like I just have this inner thought, this inner feeling, and it seems like everybody else does as well. Again, I think that kind of comes back to some shaky grounding, you know, which is why ultimately I don't believe. But I do want to, you know, put this flag post out there because I think it's always worth pointing this out. Is that, again, one of the things I love about these conversations is being able to reach across the divide and say, where do we stand shoulder to shoulder? And it is like, I mean, our Venn diagram, Eddie, I think is practically a circle. You know, we stand together on so many different things. And it's this belief, I think, that is really where we have a divide. I don't know if I know this, man. Do you believe in ghosts? Do you believe
Ooh.
No.
Yeah. Okay. But what about souls?
Yes and no.
Really?
Yeah, that's interesting for sure.
Well, let me give you a little bit of my perspective. I'm a philosophy first guy. Not that I put philosophy above theology. That's where I started, and that's where I fell in love, was philosophy. And my theology came later. And I don't like holding to beliefs because a church says I have to, or holding to a belief because it's quote-unquote tradition. Because 300 years after Christ, there was no tradition. It was by the councils that the tradition is established. And doing study into Judaism, specifically Second Temple Judaism, the way that Judaism's all over the place, but the way that the rabbinic history speaks, you go from one extreme of secular Judaism to Kabbalism. Hmm. And somewhere in the middle is like the Hasidic Jews and different sects like that. And they have a very fantastic metaphysics about reality and the soul. But there's not the soul. It's kind of like Aristotle's hylomorphism. It's the soul. It's the immaterial material that give you identity. And so that's kind of the way that I view it. A soul without my material body is not me. My material body without the soul is not me. It's this this marrying of, you know, the forms and the material. But when I talk about a soul, I talk more about I view it more as like just the ghost in the machine. And that's kind of my view. I'm not a typical dualist. I don't buy a lot of modern day Christian ideas of hell.
Sorry, what's a dualist?
A dualist. So a dualist would be one that the mind or consciousness or something like a soul exists and the material body exists, and it's two separate substances. So most physicalists, not all, most physicalists would be monist. They would think that, you know, consciousness is emergent from the brain or something of that nature. Most theists would be dualists because they think of the soul being like the true identity of the person. So it's in the philosophy of mind. It gets pretty far down a rabbit trail if we go too far into it.
Well, with that, because I think you said it a couple of times, and I think this might be something interesting. But I mean, please, I mean, yell at me and tell me to stop if it's not. But
stop.
Are you? Is it completely synonymous with identity? Because really, when we start to break down the philosophical understanding of identity, right, we very quickly get into the exact same pitfalls we get into with everything else. And it's like, well, okay, it's actually just the cells in my brain that are the neurons. And it's like, well, yeah, but your cells die and like replace themselves. And like, are you the same person? Like, how do we know we didn't just have all our memories implanted? All of that fun stuff. But is that where you see the soul is just completely synonymous? Or is there an attribute that's still more than just identity?
Well, in the philosophy of mind, identity is, so you have what's called the problem of identity. If you're not a dualist, like you said, the material is all that exists. Well, the material replicates over time. So if I'm not the collection of cells that I was 10 years ago, how can I be the same person? What is it about me that has sustained me over that time if I'm not the same material substance? So that's one of the issues of holding two different types of dualism. Is if there's an immaterial aspect of us that doesn't change because of replication, then we can sustain an identity over time. And I think, honestly, one of the reasons of holding to a type of dualism to me is the identity problem. Because, I mean, you physically aren't the same person you were 10 years ago. So if I did something 10 years ago, or that collection of cells did something 10 years ago, how can I be responsible for it today if I'm not the same collection of cells? Because they've been replicated over time.
But do you think this extra substance is, because I think you and I both agree, like, yeah, there's definitely a body, right? There's a brain, there's cells, like we're cool on that. Do you think that other substance, though, that has a lot to do with identity, but not entirely, but do you think that persists after the material aspect dies? Like, when my brain dies, does this conception of the soul? Because I do think your conception is a lot more nuanced than a lot of people. And I think it's worth making, you know, that known. But yeah, does it go on afterwards? I mean...
Yeah, just to, you know, make one clarification, even if I wasn't a theist, I would still be some type of dualist because of the identity problem.
So you don't think it comes from a deity? It's not. This is separate from that.
Well, it can fit into it.
Sure.
And I think it fits better than, you know, a solid or kind of reductionist materialism. I think that it can be kind of one of the pieces of the puzzle, but because of the identity problem and because of the problem of consciousness, the hard problem of consciousness, even if I was an atheist, I would still hold to some kind of dualism, because I don't think that physicalism is very ambiguous. I mean, there's a ton of different definitions for physicalism. So that's why I'm kind of reluctant to use physicalism. But materialism, which a lot of people, they're a theistic materialist too. But materialism itself, we have to try to figure out a way how we can keep identity over time with the change in material self, and at the same time, the hard problem of consciousness, how we can have what seems to be this abstract thing is interacting with, you know, this physical brain. How can we, you know, how do they interact? How is that possible? Which is where, you know, a lot of the different philosophies of mind come into play with monism and dualism.
Have you heard I don't even remember exactly where I heard it, but I kind of stumbled like halfway into a discussion one day, and it basically it was this concept that the beginnings of consciousness aren't actually rooted in the brain as we understand it, but more like in the spinal cord, in the sense of this was more of just a living organism receiving and responding to stimuli. And that ultimately led to what we understand as consciousness and identity and so forth. Do you think that's maybe a step in the right direction in terms of maybe answering those questions? Because I do think there is I'd be an ass if I was like, oh no, there's no mind body problem. There's no consciousness problem. No, what are you talking about? Of course there is. But I don't know that even with acknowledging that there is the problem, I don't know that we have anything to point us in that direction. And it seems to me we have more pointing us in, you know, a cell started to realize if it could, you know, things hurt it, right? And then from there, it developed all of this funky wiring that we call neurology.
Yeah, but that's really oversimplifying consciousness.
Sure.
There's, you know, because you can have non-conscious beings that respond to stimuli. But yeah, you are correct. I believe the modern thought is that consciousness actually starts in the brainstem. Mm-hmm. Because they thought that, you know, it was like for higher conscious agents, the prefrontal cortex was where agency and self-awareness and things are. And because lower primates or lower conscious entities were lacking a prefrontal cortex, and they didn't have, you know, a lot of the self-awareness attributes we have and things like that. But the further we get into neuroscience, we make a lot of correlation causation. I'm not going to say they do it fallaciously. I mean, there is a fallacy there if we extrapolate too much from that. But the further we're in the infant stages of neuroscience, and the further that we get in it and start mapping, you know, different parts of the brain and what they're responsible for, you know, for example, a stroke, a lot of times it affects the ability to communicate, speak, and things like that. Well, we have neuroplasticity where the brain will rewire itself. Yeah. So obviously that specific part of the brain wasn't important to talking. You know, it just happened to be the place that our natural original way of communication and things came about. But yeah, without going, you know, too far down into it, I think I heard a phone call come up. So
yeah, neither of us are cutting open people's skulls or doing fMRIs or anything.
Absolutely.
But I do. I think. Okay, let me, and then we'll move on to something else. But why doesn't the understanding that a rod through the brain or a stroke or any of these other, you know, events radically altering that sense of identity and that sense of, you know, sentience, even just the ability to feel stuff, right? Like we have people that have traumatic brain injuries that suddenly develop all types of synesthesia where they're smelling colors or mm-hmm. you know, hearing letters or whatever the heck it is, right? Which is fascinating. Why doesn't that cut off that option of soul or dualism for you? That seems to me, maybe not entirely, but that seems to really put some heavy weight on the side of the scale for materialism right there.
Why?
Because it seems so malleable through the physical substance. Like it seems like it's just basically Play-Doh. And if I make a cube, it's a cube. And then there's nothing inherent to the Play-Doh that is a cube. I could just turn it into a ball or any other shape. It seems that level of, I don't know if I want to say ease, but like that ability to manipulate the physical and so clearly manipulate that identity aspect, that you know, soul aspect, that seems to be just a point, and again, like a point in the category of materialism.
But doesn't that only show a relation? And the reason I ask, let me give you a...
You're talking about the correlation causation you were just talking about.
Just shows that there's a relation there. We can't measure consciousness. If consciousness was some part of an immaterial part of us, how would we know? Like, just like my mother, for example, she had a stroke. She has severe aphasia. She knows what she wants to say.
Right, right.
It just doesn't come out because of the material workings that's there. It doesn't mean she's not cognizant of everything. She's not having rational thoughts. She's not thinking about, she knows what she gets so frustrated because she knows what she wants to say. But when it comes out, it's something totally different. So without us knowing exactly what's going on with the consciousness, now we can map the brain and we can see where the brain lights up and things like that. Yeah, okay. We don't know exactly what's going on in that, you know, kind of like it's the problem of qualia, sure. what it is like to be me. Yeah. You know, there's no scientific way for anybody to know what it's like to be me. Just like we can't know what it's like to be secular. You know, it just, we're stuck at this barrier and we just can't have the experience that each independent person has.
So what about, I know I said I was going to shut up and we'll move on, but I'm just too excited. What about the idea that, so I think there's reason to say, hey, we need to look at some of these, you know, neurological studies and so forth. Again, I'm totally with that. But what if we go through the process of scanning people's brains, right, and getting a nice image, and we do that as we're showing them a red apple, right? We show them an apple, and it always lights up like this, or pretty much it lights up like this every single time. And then we put a person in the same machine, and we tell them to think of a red apple, and we get the same fucking light up. Do you think that's a good kind of bridging that correlation causation thing, or are we?
Yeah, at the end of the day, it's still a correlation. I think it's a warranted correlation. I don't think it's a fallacious correlation. I think that we're well within our, you know, epistemic rights to say that if we do 100 people, you know, that all light up, you know, the same place with a red apple, but we're still stuck with the, you know, Hume's problem of induction. I mean, we can infer that all humans are like that, but we really can't know it unless we test all humans.
But are we using a different, because you're right, the problem of induction, totally, just like the hard problem of solipsism, right? Like, none of us have a fucking answer to that, but we just kind of move on. Do you feel like we have more of a problem here with induction than we do with everything else? Is it noticeably so much more that we can't bridge that? Because, like, I have the problem of induction with, like, my car and my kitchen sink. I mean, right? Like, all the time, like everything. But
I would be hesitant off the cuff to say yes or no. I'd really have to think about it because, I mean, induction is induction. It's, you know, we have, I would say on the surface of it, first reaction, I would say knowing gravity exists through induction, you know, it seems to be more on solid ground than saying a certain part of the brain lights up when there's a red apple. They are inferences and they are induction, but I would seem to want to say that the idea that gravity exists is, it's probably a tighter connection there. I want to throw one wrench in there for you.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with cognitive behavioral therapy?
A little bit, yeah.
Cognitive behavioral therapy, they teach you how to reprocess information in the proper way. Mm-hmm. Cognitive behavioral therapy actually changes the physical structure of the brain. Mm-hmm. So by thinking a certain way, mm-hmm. thoughts you are changing the physical makeup mm-hmm. of the brain. So if the brain is responsible for consciousness, how can this immaterial act of changing the way you think about things and process it actually change the physical structure of the brain? To me, yeah. that's insane.
It almost seems to me, though, like learning a new skill. Like I didn't know how to juggle it one time, and now I can half-ass it. But I have friends out there that, you know, put them blindfolded in front of pianos, right? Or guitars or anything, you name it, right? I think they're, and this definitely will probably take us down another rabbit hole too, but I was hearing some more stuff on dreams and how valuable that is and what that could be and what it could be doing and so forth. And it may be, at least on some level, it may be a way for the brain to process difficult experiences that we've had. Like a lot of us, I think, if not all of us out there, have had those like upsetting dreams that are frightening or sad or whatever it is. And it's possible that this is something that, I'm using very base level terms. I hope we all know that, but this is something that the brain came up with as a way to deal with past trauma. And if that is the case, then I could kind of understand the cognitive, the CBT aspect of it, because it seems to me that, yeah, this is something that the brain is already kind of doing. Now, I don't want to go down this route either, but yes, technically when we're dreaming, we're synthesizing just a bunch of DMT, and maybe that has something to do with it too. I sure as hell don't know. But I don't know. I guess for me, it seems on a lot of these types of talks, it seems like a lot of times me and the other person, we agree on like A, B, C. Right. And I think that's where you and I are. We agree like there's something here. We agree like I'm a person, you're a person. We agree like brain does crazy stuff. But then there's the D that you're throwing out there where I feel like we don't mesh on. And I don't know what I have to push me to accept that next letter. You know, like what do you think is the best evidence for this immaterial material, right?
Real quick, do we have a call waiting?
Oh yeah, if we got a call, shut us up.
So they're finishing up the screening process, so they'll be here in okay. one minute. So if all you right. want to just go yeah, ahead yeah. and keep your answer short. Absolutely.
Well, so this is actually going to take us in kind of another direction. I am a minimal idealist. I think that at the fundamental level, reality, it's mental and not physical or material. And one of the reasons is principle of parsimony. If everything is fundamentally conscious, there's not a hard problem of consciousness. It's a problem for materialists. Because the consciousness and the mental is fundamental.
Yeah.
And with the materialist, we're adding in another entity, which is the brain. And how can that consciousness interact with material unless the material is somehow part of the consciousness? So to me, it makes more sense whether theism is true or not. That's not really
right,
relevant
it's not on the
to,
table, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because if you're not familiar with Bernardo Castro, he's an objective idealist. And it has a lot to do with these issues of the hard problem of consciousness, consciousness itself. How do you get consciousness out of a material, a strictly material universe? You know, how do we go from, you know, rocks and dirt and all these things to this, this to qualia, you know, these self-awareness things that we call consciousness. Now, I can understand why a materialist would say, yeah, if it's material, then the consciousness is just an emergent property of the brain. But the issue is emergence itself is extremely controversial. You know, exactly what is emergence? How does the material get to that? So because of all of these issues, to me, it just seems like, you know, especially when we look at it at the quantum level, how we have, you know, fundamental particles popping in and out of existence, you know, they're massless. So it's not the same kind of material that we experience all the time. And it just seems to me that if it's like a shared consciousness amongst all living beings, or, you know, it just is this kind of consciousness that's universal and everything. I'm not saying everything is just a projection of the mind.
Sure.
I think that there is an objective world that is, I think there is an objective material world, but it's ultimately because of the mental that all of this exists, or we experience it the way we do.
You're just to be sure, you're coming down on the same side where the great philosopher Sting says we are spirits in a material world. Am I wrong? If you don't know the Police song, go listen.
You are the first person I've ever had actually use Sting in a philosophical. That wins you like 1,000 points. Right,
pretty sure he's right up there with Plato and the rest. So.
All right, you guys ready to take your first call?
Let's do it. Yes.
All right, so we've got Sven from Washington. I'll actually just let Sven explain his question. He's a theist. Sven, you're on with Secular Rarity and Eddie. How you doing?
Good evening, Eddie and Secular. Doing well. How are you guys?
Good.
Good. So what did you want to ask?
Good. So, yeah, I just wanted to comment on a Secular earlier in the conversation. You had said when there's a brain injury, we witness a change in personality and how that could be considered a point towards materialism. And I know we've talked about that before, and so I guess I had been thinking on it. And wouldn't that be expected in a dualist worldview as well? Because in a dualist worldview, we do have our soul or our spirit inside of the animal body. And so if there's a shift in the animal body, then we would expect a change in the way the soul can experience this reality. Does that make sense?
I definitely think I'm following along. There's a couple of different places I think I could push back. But one definitely interests me more than the rest, but I'll just kind of signpost them. I'm still in the boat where I'm not convinced by any positive evidence for a soul. So I think I would need to establish at least some groundwork there a little bit more for me. I would also want to ask about the mechanism of interaction between the soul or the immaterial with the stuff that is material. But this is the first question that really came to mind was, it seems to me then that in that scenario, if we're accepting that the dualist is correct here, then I will grant that, yes, I think there is a good case to be made that altering the physical would have at least some play on the immaterial aspect. But it sounds to me almost like you're granting that the physical is 60-40 to the soul as opposed to 50-50. Does that make sense?
Like, it does. Yes, I can see where I'm giving more weight to the soul than the material.
Well, and what's confusing me there is, If that is the case, so what could we do to the soul that could alter the physical in such a way? Now, I think the thing that Eddie brought up earlier about cognitive behavioral therapy definitely is something for us to keep looking into. I'm not just writing that off right away, but it doesn't seem to me the same severity that it is, right? Like it seems to be, you don't have to do much to the physical to really radically alter that other part of it. And where is that divide? If it's not 50-50 and it's 60-40 or 70-30 to the material, how do we determine that? How do we show that without being able to say, here is what that other 30% is, 40%, you know?
Right. I could make, I don't know how well versed in this I am, but I could make the argument that like spiritual awakenings, no matter whether they are real or of the brain, they do have a huge change on someone's experience in reality. So
I don't
say there's 60-40%. Go on.
Well, no, I was just going to say, I don't discount that. Although I think, again, just, you know, signposting it and moving on, I think I could say, you know, what do you mean by spiritual? What do you mean by spiritual awakening? But let's just move past that. I think there is a decent enough case to be made that what people often, these fantastical feelings and experiences that people have that are often then ultimately labeled as spiritual awakenings, I think there's definitely good reason to say this can radically alter somebody's character, their personality, their life path, their plan, their actions, whatever it is. But I don't know that that's anything more fantastic than a dream or anything more fantastic than a beautiful concert or the greatest date you've ever been on. You know, I don't know that we have anything to indicate that it's something outside of all the really cool brainy biologically stuff that we know for a fact happens, right? Like for some reason, our brain every so often is like happy drug. And then other times it's just like sad drug. And it's like, sometimes we can play with that and sometimes we can't, but it, none of this seems to me that it's pointing towards anything immaterial, I guess, is kind of where I end up shaking out on it. But what do you think, Eddie? Anything on that?
You okay there, Eddie?
Yeah. It's crazy that we're talking about this because, like I mentioned, my mom, who had a stroke, has severe aphasia.
Yeah.
And she literally can say like two words. And she just texted me the first coherent sentence.
No way.
That I've got from her since she had her stroke years ago.
I'm sorry.
Oh, it's awesome.
I mean, yeah, that's huge. That's huge, yeah. Man. That's fucking amazing.
Yeah, don't apologize for your feelings.
Yeah, that is. That's a super, super huge deal. And real quick, I think, again, this is another place where Eddie and I can stand completely clear-headed, clear-eyed, shoulder-to-shoulder on this. Why the hell are we not doing more to study the brain? Guys, we're doing stuff, don't get me wrong, but this is undeniably one of the most important things for us to be studying. And the more that we come to understand this, I really do think a lot of the problems that we see will diminish. And I'm so excited. I'm so excited to see what comes next of it, you know? It's honestly, it's fascinating to me the amount of progress that we have made on so many different things. I was lucky enough years ago, there's this exhibit called Bodies, where it's a bunch of cadavers, people that have donated their bodies to science over the years. And they basically inject this kind of like stiffening gel into the various cells and the body parts. So what they do is they take, you know, a cadaver, for instance, and they inject this all throughout the lungs and just the lungs. And then they pull that out, and now it's a solid, you know, piece, and they put it behind, you know, glass, and they tell you about it. It was just fascinating when I got to the brain section. They had, you know, not only different little slices of it just all laid next to each other, but just the whole brain itself. And again, I think there's definitely more to look at and more to look for sure. I don't in any way, shape, or form want to just tie it up with a bow and say we finished all our investigation, right? But right now I'm at the place where I can't move towards positively saying there's a black swan. You know, I'm absolutely not ruling out black swans categorically. But even still, either way, right? Whether we know what the heck is out there next, tomorrow, either way, I think us as a global society, putting more effort into understanding this squishy substance up here is really, really, really going to be helpful. And honestly, man, again, that's amazing. I think that's so awesome, Eddie.
I appreciate it. That's kind of... I mean, just kind of out of the blue, and it's just crazy. This is what we're talking about, and
yeah,
you know, therefore God.
You just go ahead and call me a sinner and tell me I'm going to go to hell, Eddie. You know, you.
I didn't, you know what? I don't think you're going to go to hell, but I do think you love sin and hate God.
Well,
I told you I'd get it in there.
That's all right. I'm not pulling it out just yet, y'all, but Eddie will be accounting for all the crimes that Christianity has ever committed here in a moment. So,
whoa.
I've got him. I got him on a list.
Oh, is the caller still there? Or?
Yeah, Sven, did they get to all your questions, or is there more you wanted to expand on?
Yeah, no, I just really wanted to make that one point in the conversation. I definitely didn't think I would get secular convinced of a soul tonight. Maybe I definitely got to do a lot more research for that, but
you were close. You were close.
All right, Sven, thank you so much.
We'll talk to you guys soon.
All right, have a good one. If you're interested in asking either host a question, the number is at the bottom of the screen, 951-364-2430. How are you guys feeling?
Great. I have some pushback on secular.
All right. Please. What you got, man? Pushback. What you got? What? Fire right. away.
You said something earlier that really kind of got my insides going.
Oh.
When you said that intuition is shaky ground.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
I wish I had some of these off the top of my head. I think you're probably familiar with Cease to Know and J Mike over Axioms on Trial, which, by the way, plug real quick. Great people. Go check them out. Eddie, you've got a channel too, right? Brute Facts Podcast. It can be found all over the place.
And I've been on
the link
show
is in
too.
The description of the video.
That's right. I'll take any moment to just shamelessly shill.
I'll take it.
But I was listening to Cease have a chat the other day, and he was talking about, you know, various things out there that, like, our intuition is just wrong. It's just flat out wrong on it. Like these things that seem to be. I forget some of the examples he was using. I should have prepared more. I'll blame that on myself. But it seems to be the case that as we dig further and further into, because I don't think common sense and intuition are the same exactly. I think we colloquially sometimes use it like that, but not at all. I think there's definitely something more nuanced and fundamental about seemingly being an agent, a conscious agent, where we're talking about here. But because we have been shown so incorrect on intuition in various places, it seems to me like that alone can't be it. That alone can't be it. Like, I have an intuition that, you know, walking home at night, I'm by myself, dark night, scary alleyway. I have an intuition, right? But that's not just intuition. Like, that's grounded on a lot of different things. Yes, some experience, of course, in there. But just like data, right? Like statistics, like just how many people in my area have been, you know, physically assaulted or something. So I think to just wrap it all up, I think if we're only using intuition, if that's the only thing, I'm always going to be like, I don't know if that gets us there. I don't know if that gets us over that hump to demonstrate, right?
Is that your intuition?
All right, sounded like Frank Turek over here.
What do you take intuition to be? This is more important than
yeah. I'm not
a lot of people.
I'm not positive that I have a succinct definition off the cuff. I don't know that I've ever, gone super, super deep into this for sure. Yeah. This is definitely something I could use more studying on, but maybe just innate understanding as a conscious agent. Yeah, I'm not 100% positive that I would have a good succinct definition, but if you've got something, please, I mean, tell me what your thoughts are on it.
Yeah. I'm not going to, you know, play Darth and lead you down a hole and
you could trap you.
No, philosophy and intuition is an initial reaction to something without inferring anything. You're not arguing your way to it. You're not going through evidence. It's your initial instinct on that. So for example, if I look out the window and I see that there's a squirrel at the bottom of the tree, I immediately form the belief there's a squirrel at the bottom of the tree. I didn't have to argue my way to it. I didn't have to go through different types of evidences and all these things. It was my initial reaction to it. So intuition, what it plays in philosophy is we start with intuition. We have an intuition that the external world exists. We have an intuition that there are concrete objects in the world. Then we use inference and other methods of reasoning to come to some kind of conclusion. Well, when we come to that conclusion, we usually stop where it seems to us that that's the right answer. Well, that's your intuition. It's what it seems to be to you. So Aristotle had the infinite justification problem. Yeah. If I ask you to justify something, say you go through the empirical method and you say, well, yeah, this can be tested. It can be verified. It can be falsified. Somebody else can do it and they can do it and they can do it. Well, then I ask you, why do you think that it's true because of that?
Sure.
So you got to give me a justification for that. And then I can ask you, why do you think of that? Why do you think that's right? Well, you got to give me a justification of that. And there's this infinite chain of justification. Well, you have to stop somewhere without going on to infinity trying to justify it. And where we stop is our intuition, what seems to be true to us. So if we take something that's verifiable because and it rolls into the problem of induction also. It rolls into the problem of solipsism, all this. There are certain things we have to accept about reality in order to operate in reality. Sure. And it starts with our intuition that we exist outside of our mind.
So let me push back a little bit on that, because that is interesting. And I think there's, again, I know for a fact I'm lacking in more study on this and need to do more. But I mean, it sounds really similarly like the prime mover contingency, but just more focused in the sense of reason and justification, right? Like there has to be a beginning justification to justify all the other justification, just like there has to be a
I wouldn't tie it into any arguments for God.
Not even God, just your basic contingency, just that there has to be the starting point
Agrippa's trilemma or Munchausen trilemma. It's everything is either infinite regress, brute fact, or arbitrary, I think it is. I think that's the three. We all start from that because we can't have an infinite justification. There's no way. I mean, I could ask you for 6 days straight the same line of questions, you know. Sure. Well, why are you justified in that? Why do you think that's true? Why are you justified in that? Why are you just, you know, we can just keep going back because there is good justification for holding to a position. I mean, that's what epistemology is all about. But at the end of the day, we're going to have to say there's something else there that ends that regress of problems.
So it sounded like, because I think I'm following along, and definitely please again shut me up if I'm not.
Shut up.
Yeah. But it seemed to me that you were saying this is something that we come to without that prior experience, that prior evidence. We're not arguing our way through it. We're not going through steps. This is just your most very basic belief. Is that where you're coming at?
Well, yeah, technically it'd be called properly basic beliefs and
epistemology.
Properly basic.
Thank you.
Yeah, but I don't think it necessarily comes outside. Experience does shape our intuition.
See, that's what I was thinking when you gave the example of seeing the squirrel. I feel like the only reason that I come to that intuition of the squirrel being there is because I have prior experience with like squirrels and stuff like that. Like it seems to me that that's not intuitive so much in the sense that you were describing it. But again,
well, it is intuitive because all you've done is put a name to it by experience. If you didn't speak English or you didn't speak language or anything, you'd form the belief that there is something at the bottom of the tree.
Sure, fuzzy little animal. Sure.
Yeah, something like that. The English language or language itself actually puts the labels on the proposition.
But does the acceptance of the fuzzy four-legged little whatever the fuck does that? I'm pretty sure that's the proper term.
That's the philosophical term.
Yeah. Pretty sure. But does.
I need to interrupt in a moment because we have another caller.
Oh, no. Shut me up. We'll just go to the caller. Seriously.
When we get to the super chat, that's going to answer the question for you, Secular, of I said intuition.
Yeah, that's good.
We have a $5 super chat. I have an intuition that there is no God. Apparently, by Eddie's reasoning, that's true.
Well, okay, I'll collect my winnings and I'll go home, y'all. I appreciate it.
Our next caller wants to know about moral facts. Joe, you are on with SR and Eddie. How are you?
Hey, SR. Hey, Eddie. How are you?
Pretty good.
So it looks like Joe wants to know, and correct me if I'm wrong, if moral facts exist. Is that accurate?
Yeah. That was my question. I've watched some of Eddie's stuff, and I like some of his stuff. And congratulations on your mother, Eddie, for getting a little better. So.
Thank you so much.
I'd love to hear what Eddie thinks about morality and what his opinions are on the existence of moral facts.
Yeah.
I would say, just
real quick, Eddie, for everybody, would you just give a quick elevator what moral facts are, what you understand that to be?
I'm not going to do it justice, but so moral realism is the position that there are moral facts in the world. And what that means is certain things are truly right or wrong. In other words, it is a true statement or a false statement. for example, one of the one that's often used in philosophy, and I'll be careful because I don't want the channel get flagged or something like that. Let's just say if we are doing really bad things to certain young humans for the fun of it, most of us initially, back to intuition, most of us have the initial reaction, something is wrong there, you know, and we would want to say that regardless if it happened in a different society who had different values or a different time or a different place, it's always wrong to do that for the fun of it. And that's what the moral realist will say about moral facts. It is a moral fact. It is true that that is truly wrong. For example, like chattel slavery in the United States. At the time, they thought they were doing the right thing, or at least tried to justify it. Well, the moral realist would say, no, it doesn't matter if they tried to justify it or not. It is wrong across all time, all places, any culture. It doesn't matter what the culture thinks about it. It is definitely something that's wrong to do. And traditionally, I have been a moral realist, but I am actually starting to kind of rethink my position. And the reason being is, shameless plug, Thursday, I have Lance Bush coming on, who is, he works in the field of psychology of morality and philosophy of morality. And he has some, and I'm very interested in psychology, and he has some very interesting takes on the psychology of morality. So when we talk about these moral intuitions, which I've had, you know, Russ Schaefer Landau on, who is a non-naturalist moral realist. He's an atheist, but he's still a moral realist. Most philosophers are moral realists. I'm like, with Russ Schaefer Landau, it just seems to me that some things truly are wrong. But getting into Lance's work on the psychology of that has been super interesting. So right now and traditionally, I would say I'm a moral realist, real loosely. I do believe there are moral facts, but the more that I learned about the actual psychology of that, I may be, you know, kind of moving away from that position.
Joe, any other thoughts? Hello? Or...
Yeah, so wondering, Eddie, are you then if you're leaning towards there's no moral facts, then you would be saying that there's kind of no such thing as good or evil.
Well, that's where the waters kind of get muddy, because while I have an intuition that there are moral facts, I don't think moral realism is required to say that things are wrong or evil versus good necessarily. It could be that our attitudes towards moral facts, you know, given our psychology, is what makes it seem like moral facts do exist. As a theist, I do lean towards there being an objective morality, and if there's a grounding for that morality, a metaphysical grounding, it would seem that God would be that metaphysical grounding. But that's just not a very powerful argument to me, because there are so many different moral positions and metaphysical grounding for morality. So I don't know if it necessarily follows that it doesn't mean there's good and evil. It would just change what the criteria of good and evil is.
And I would probably stand right next to you there. I think in years past, I would have just said, you know, unequivocally, like, yes, there is right, there is wrong, absolute, objective. Hell yeah, doesn't matter. But I think I definitely see where Eddie's coming from about the idea that it isn't necessarily one of the criteria that's needed to get to where I think most of us want to go, right? I don't think we necessarily need that for us to like try to, you know, advocate for not, you know, killing people and stuff. You know what I'm saying? Like, I do think there is a way to that. That being said, though, I think I also understand the other side where it's kind of just like, I know Sam Harris definitely is well known for this, where it just all boils down to the facts. Just the straight up, you put your hand on a hot stove, what it does to the cells on your skin, the pain that you feel, like that's just where it all boils down to. And I can kind of understand that side too. Again, I do think it is always worth remembering that if there is somebody that is doing something like one of those things Eddie was talking about earlier, where we generally all pretty easily say, oh no, that's not right. I think whether or not the person next to me uses the same methodology to get there, we at least need to, you know, lock arms in that moment and say, hey, yeah, that guy, you know, maybe you come to it through this method. Maybe I come to it through this method. Hey, maybe I don't think moral realism is a thing. But again, that guy's a dick and we need to make sure he stops, you know. So yeah. It's funky. And I remember the first time that I heard the is ought problem. And then I remember the first time that somebody said, well, you don't even need oughts. And I was just like, what? And that's really nice. But there is a pragmatism that we have to care about, right? There is something about us interacting with the world tomorrow and waking up. And I think that may be one of the things that kind of says even without those moral facts, we can still get to the answer that a lot of us want to get to. Again, there is that immediate situation of the harm that's being caused that nobody really disagrees with except for that one person. And that doesn't mean obviously that we just, you know, kill the guy and torture him or whatever, but it does mean that we don't allow them to continue the terrible things.
Let's get one thing straight. I'm the philosopher here. Don't be introducing terms like pragmatism. Stay inside your box. No, just playing.
Joe, did they sufficiently answer your questions?
Yeah, is it all right if I push back on Eddie a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to say.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of time, but we have a little time.
Yeah, push back, definitely.
Yeah, sure. Okay, great. Yeah. When I think about morality, I think about two things crashing into each other. I think about self-interest, and then we have the idea of something that is good. And when those two things crash into each other, then we come to moral situations. So, you know, we all have our own selfish desires. And then you have to ask yourself, well, where do these moral obligations to other living beings come from? And I think a lot of us look at morality and we think evil or is some irrational thing, but really it's just people acting in pure self-interest. And for me, I ask, well, why is that wrong to act in pure self-interest? And I couldn't, on naturalism, I couldn't see any reason why anybody would have any moral duties or obligations to others. And I think, you know, I think we all think that, you know, it's nice and stuff, but I can't see any basis for why anybody would have these duties.
Yeah, and that's a fair point. And that's part of the kind of the struggle in my, you know, evolution of my, you know, ethical theory, because I would disagree with secular. There most definitely is an is-ought problem. How do we... Or I'm sorry if that's not what you were saying, secular.
No, you can.
I think that we do have moral oughts, and how do we get from, you know, analyzing the world in a scientific way, and that's this is how things are, to we ought to do this, we ought to do that. Science can't answer why we ought to do things. It can tell us the mechanism through evolution, why we might feel like, you know, we have oughts, but it doesn't answer the question exactly why we ought to care about the planet, animals, other people, things of that nature. You know, they can, you can appeal to herd mentality and things like this, but that's still just the mechanism. That's not the reason why we ought to do things. So you make a fair point. And that's one of the areas that, you know, I'm still thinking about as I go through, you know, the psychological aspect to it.
And I would just say, I mean, real quick, I'll just clarify. All I was saying about the you don't even need aughts is I heard somebody made that argument. I thought, yeah. Oh man, I've got so much more to do. Yeah, I don't know exactly where I hash out on that entirely, but I would just push back a little bit, Joe, and say that it sounded like a second ago you were saying that just purely acting in a manner of self-interest is evil. And I don't know that that's necessarily the case. I think there is a decent enough argument to be made that somebody receives such incredible pleasure from doing things for other people that they are ultimately being a everything valuable about what it means to be a good person in society in our eyes. But doing it from purely just I feel good and it makes me happy tomorrow, you know? But again, I don't know 100% where I shake out on this. And I do think there's a lot to hash out. I do think there's a lot, but it is hard for me for sure. Because I kind of go back to where we were earlier when it came to like dualism in the soul, is that I feel like in these conversations, I'm agreeing with the other person and we're both saying, yep, A's there, B's there, C's there. And it's like, perfect. And then we go, but there's D. There's this nebulous concept of oughtness, you know? And it's like, is that really something different, or is it something that just derives from the A, B, and C, you know? And I'm not sure that we really do have super solid evidence either way. I think Eddie and I would definitely agree that you don't have to believe in a God to be a good person. You know, but at the same time, it is hard to bridge that gap. If there is one, it's very hard to bridge that gap. If there's not one, we've got a whole nother fucking discussion to have. But yeah, I this one is still one I play with, and it keeps me up at night, and I cry a lot about it. And I feel like if you're not crying at night about philosophy, you're just not doing it right. I mean,
amen to that.
Awesome. Joe, thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you, man.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Have a good one.
Definitely. I appreciate it.
All right. Is there anything before we get out of here, anything else you two gentlemen wanted to close with?
Yes. I wanted to address that super chat, which will tie all the points in together with secular that I was making about intuition.
I have intuition. There is no God. Apparently, by Eddie's reasoning, that is true.
Yes, that is true. What I mean by an intuition and believing in God, we start with an intuition. Then we investigate reality and through inference. So the purpose of me being in philosophy and learning these metaphysical arguments, philosophy of religion and things, is not to convince other people. It's to make sure my position is rational and defensible. Yeah. If I don't find any overwhelming defeaters for my position, then I can go with my intuition and be justified in it. Same thing with you. If you even if you started with the intuition that God exists, and then you go through the arguments and philosophy and experience in life and, you know, all these things about life, and you find that, wow, it doesn't seem to me that God exists. Well, then, as long as you've done your epistemic duty, you're justified in believing God doesn't exist. And this is something I make clear on a regular basis is, I think it's an abductive case either way. There's not one argument that gets you to God, and there's not one argument that gets you to atheism or agnosticism. It's like a pendulum. And it just kind of, for different people, it swings on different sides of the wall. You know, I can look at all these metaphysical arguments for God, and at the end of the day, it seems to me that God exists. I would be irrational to say, no, God doesn't exist if it seems to me that he exists. And the same thing for the atheist. I don't think that, I think there are some irrational atheists, but I think there's plenty of irrational theists. But anybody who's looked at, you know, the evidences or the arguments or investigated it, and they just find themselves not convinced, there's nothing wrong with that position. Just like if they've done their epistemic duty and they come to the conclusion that they believe God exists, that's fine. Now, I don't deny that those intuitions may have some influence from growing up in a Judeo-Christian society. You know, if I was in another society, I might think that another God or some definition of God exists. But at the end of the day, I can only go on what seems to be true to me. I can only try to be as objective and unbiased as possible while evaluating all these things. And if I just don't find anything that clearly says God doesn't exist, then I feel I'm justified in holding to my position.
And holding on the intuition. That's interesting for sure. So, more work to be done and just kind of flagging it and moving on more than anything. But I'm a correspondence theory of truth kind of guy. And based. So like that leaves, there's one person out there that's laughing their ass off right now, but I think with that, for me, that leads me to the understanding of evidence being essentially, you know, a body of facts, right? Facts being just corresponding to what is, but a body of facts that positively indicate a single outcome. And I guess my problem is that it seems to me that if at the end of the day the dividing line between us is intuition, and I'm using intuition and you're using intuition and we're coming to different conclusions, there seems to me something obviously problematic with that. Because how would we come to different conclusions if we're using, you know, it just doesn't seem like a super reliable method. And again, maybe there's more. I mean, I know there's more that I need to study on this. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just, before you get too far on it, I didn't mean to cut you off. Mm-hmm. But that's exactly what I was talking about. Even with the scientific method, you're going to stop at intuition unless you have an infinite regress of justification. You got to stop where it seems to be true to you. It seems to me that gravity is true. It seems to you that gravity is true. We can go through all these different methods to prove that gravity is true. But when we had that justification for that, if somebody asked me, why am I justified in thinking it's, well, because it's falsifiable. Well, why are you justified in believing things that are falsifiable? Well, because I think it's a good method to determine what's true. Why are you justified in thinking it's a good method to determine it's true? Well, because other people see it too. Why are you justified that other people see it too? We can just keep going and going and going, and we get stuck in this chain of justification. We have to stop somewhere, and that's where intuition comes in.
Maybe this is just going over my head, but why don't you think that sticking point, that stop is just logic, and we just all accept that we don't have a great answer for that. It's like it all comes from that. Everything that seems to exist seems to follow these three rules, and from there we get all these other fantastical, nonsensical whatevers. But I mean, why is that not that ground point? And intuition is really just an application of basic logic and how reality responds to stuff.
Yeah, because we can employ all the rules, logic, reason, rationality that we want, but it's still going to seem so. In epistemology, I'm not a phenomenal conservative, but there's this position called phenomenal conservatism. We all start with properly basic beliefs, and it's actually an evidentialist kind of epistemology, or what's known as internalism. And what it states is, you ought to believe what seems to be true to you, because to believe something that doesn't seem true to you is irrational.
Yeah.
You know, so we all have these seemings, is what they call it in phenomenal conservatism, that things seem to be a certain way. Well, if it seems to be that way, then that's what you ought to hold to.
Okay, so hang on real quick. You said you're not, though. You're not a phenomenal conservative. Why aren't you a phenomenal conservative, then?
Because there's no justification for the properly basic beliefs that they hold at the foundation. Their very own epistemology can't account for the properly basic beliefs that they hold to. They say, but that goes back to, like I was saying, we have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
So it's like an axiom.
You switch that with intuition is your axiom there.
Well, it is an intuition. It is intuition is what it is. It's just in phenomenal conservatism, they call it seeming.
Okay,
Because that's actually a more accurate term, because things seem to be a certain way to us. And, you know, for example, my younger brother's schizophrenic. He lives in a whole different world than I do.
Sure.
Is he justified in believing the things that he sees? Absolutely. That's his experience. That's what seems to be true to him. So he's justified. Now, you got to remember, justification is a weak claim in epistemology. It doesn't mean that he's warranted in it.
Sure.
It doesn't mean that he can count it as knowledge. Justification is like the first step in epistemology. You know, so
we got the J, we need the T and the B here.
JTB is way outdated. There's lots of problems with it, but holding to the position I do, science, intuition, all these different things are not a problem with me, because I'm a probabilist. I think that our beliefs ought to be in proportion to the evidence.
Sure.
And we have what's called credence. The stronger the belief, because of more evidence, the more confident that I can be in it. So there's not a problem with induction with me, because I think that there's enough there at scientific findings that we can have a high credence in it, and we can call it knowledge. But it's the same thing with rationalism. You know, you have a priori truths, you know, before experience. I can know before experience that a bachelor is an unmarried man. I don't have to put that through any kind of scientific test or anything like that.
I don't know about that one. Like I hear a lot of time when people are discussing this, they often use something like that, where it's a logical contradiction, but I'm not so sure. I feel like if I had never experienced, like, I guess what I'm just going to say, like the results of logic, right? Like A is A, meaning that like this cup is this cup and it's not anything else, right? Had I not experienced that at some point, it's hard for me to say that I would come to the conclusion that a married bachelor isn't possible. You know, I don't know on that, honestly, because it seems to me that while, yes, at the end of the day, we don't have that, again, that nice bow that wraps up the laws of logic and explains them for us, but it does seem to be the case that we kind of formulate these, at least in our history of a society. Like Aristotle and his buddies sat around just writing shit down, looking at stuff, right? I mean, you know, for a long time, they did this a lot. I mean, you know, Newton went outside, he watched an apple drop, he picked it up, he dropped it again, you know, like that's how we get to this stuff. I don't know. It's interesting. I'm not sure 100% that you can come to those.
conclusion. Oh, thank you. Yeah, yeah, because I don't believe in certainty either. That's So, no, but just to wrap it all up, because there is controversy in philosophy about whether you can have a priori truths outside of experience eventually. But okay, the thing is, but a lot, it's not a popular controversy, because an unmarried male is a bachelor by definition. You don't have to know what a bachelor is. You don't have to know what married or any of that means. I can tell you that a bachelor is an unmarried man. Therefore, it's, you know, the synthetic analytic distinction. Right. You know, it's an analytic statement. It's true by definition. You don't have to have experience about it. You might have to have experience to understand what those correlate to in reality. But the proposition, a bachelor is an unmarried man, is true by definition.
Yeah, surprisingly, I don't know that we finished. I don't know that we finished this conversation, Eddie. We might just have to do it again. I honestly thought we were going to answer all of these questions tonight. I'm so surprised.
Every one of the philosophical quandaries that are out there.
You know, we ought to go ahead and collect our damn Nobel Prizes, right?
Yeah, because we figured it all out.
All right, where can everyone check you guys out at? Eddie, you first.
Oh, yeah. I have a website, brutefacts.com, a YouTube channel, Brute Facts Podcast, on YouTube. I'm actually far more successful in the podcast sphere than YouTube, but it's on all major podcast platforms, iHeart, Apple, Google, all of them. So you can download the shows or just listen to them from your browser. Go to the channel, like, subscribe, or go to the website, and it's got everything else there.
Awesome. SR?
Definitely go check out Eddie's stuff, y'all. For me, you know, we're in 2022. It's all about branding. I got all the things. You want to find me on the TikToks or the YouTubes. It's all secularity. It's all the same. I mostly just shill for other people because I get to hop on their wonderful shows like whenever Ethan lets me on here. By the way, tomorrow, 7 p.m. Central, this great channel, there's going to be the perspective with is it Student Dr. Ben and Richard Gilliver? Is that who's
going
on?
Yes, it is.
Oh my gosh, it's going to be great. So y'all definitely go see that. Every
Dr.
so often.
Ben's awesome.
Oh yeah. I love Ben. I'm so happy to see him doing more stuff. I get to hang out with the nonprofits over on the ACA. So 3 p.m. Central's there every now and then. But otherwise, I get to bug Eddie every so often. And, you know, Eddie, you were so embarrassed tonight. You were destroyed, bro. Like, how do you show your face after this?
I know. I get my ass kicked so much by secularity. I don't know why I continue to want to go to places where
you're into it. He just
owns me every time.
Awesome. Well, thanks, guys. As SR said, we'll be back here tomorrow night at 7 p.m. for The Perspective with Student Dr. Ben and Richard Gilliver. If you haven't yet, check out go to my channel and click the Recovering from Religion fundraiser. There is a link. Click Get Reminder. That's on February 19th from 6 to 10 p.m. We have 34 atheist YouTubers involved across the board, from people like Anthony Magnabosco, Objectively Dan, Seth Andrews, Genetically Modified Skeptic, Cindy Plaza, Rationality Rules. The list just goes on. Paul Agia, Shannon Q, Kenneth Leonard, Hannah Vaughn. There are so many people coming, and it's going to be awesome. That's February 19th. So everyone, thanks for watching. Eddie, SR, thank you for being a part of this. And everyone have a good night.
Absolutely. Thank you.